I'm Shane Morris. Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast. Today we present John Stone Street's interview with Dr. Aaron Cariotti, director of the bioethics program at UC Irvine, about the church's response to mental illness and the nation's growing suicide epidemic. What advice does Dr. Cariotti have for those with loved ones struggling with mental illness? And how can the church support them? Here are John Stone Street and Dr. Aaron Cariotti.
We're going to jump into a topic on today's Breakpoint podcast, something we haven't talked about on the podcast. We do talk about it on the Breakpoint commentary. Both Eric Metaxas and I have addressed this issue. It's an issue that you don't hear a lot of churches talk about. There's not a lot of Christian worldview angles on it. But the attention on mental illness is thankfully higher now than it's ever been. Unfortunately, that's due to a surge in suicide. I think it's due to certainly school shootings, which are tragic, and some high profile suicides. I think in particular of Pastor Rick Warren, Rick and Kay Warren's son. And so we wanted to talk about it on the podcast. I've been reading for the last several years Somebody in First Things. And he's been writing on this, I think, in really profound ways. Seen some terrific videos on YouTube of his presentations. Dr. Aaron Cariotti, who's the director of the bioethics program at the School of Medicine at the University of California, Irvine, MD from Georgetown University. He's got a whole series of very important articles in First Things. Come to breakpoint.org, click on the link that says resources mentioned on the radio and podcast, and we'll link you to these articles. Over at First Things. But Dr. Cariotti, first, let me say thanks for joining us on the Breakpoint podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, John.
So really what I want to talk about is this integration of Christianity and mental illness. And I know you come from a Catholic perspective. Many of our listeners, I myself would, self-identify as evangelical Protestant. It's not something, certainly mental health is not something that's been high on our list of things to talk about. There's a stigma surrounding it. There's a stigma around the whole idea of psychiatry, probably because intentional and verbal godlessness of some of the big figures of psychiatry during the 20th century, if you think about, Freud and others. But it does seem that more and more Christians are beginning to take this seriously and say, look, what does the gospel have to say about mental illness? Is that something that you're seeing as well?
Absolutely, John. And I think you're right to say that historically in the 20th century, we saw sort of mutual suspicion on the part of religious believers and psychiatrists. You pointed to Sigmund Freud, who famously claimed that religion was not only mistaken, religious belief or faith was not only wrong-headed, but it was actually a sickness. He called it the universal obsessive neurosis of mankind. Now, this, of course, was not a scientific conclusion from the psychological sciences. This was Freud's own philosophy, his own materialistic atheism sort of masquerading as a scientific claim. But I think the time has come now to recognize that there's really no reason for this kind of mutual mistrust, that all truth comes from God, the Creator, and so the truths of science, rightly understood and rightly interpreted, and the truths of God's revelation, rightly understood, can never really contradict one another. So I think Christians, Catholic, Evangelical, Protestant, Orthodox, have nothing to fear from good science. We can be wary of philosophical claims that claim to be scientific and are not, but we don't need to fear medicine or sound findings from the psychological sciences or from psychiatry. And as you pointed out, unfortunately, with the rise of especially problems like suicide among young people, rising rates of depression and anxiety among adolescents and young adults in the United States, the time has come, I think, for the church to have a serious conversation about mental illness, about reaching out to those who struggle with or suffer from mental illness, caring for them, providing pastoral care for them and for their families, so that they can truly feel integrated into the Christian community, so that they know that their particular form of suffering, the crosses that God has allowed in their lives, are understood by others, not that you know, we can necessarily solve all of their problems with a snap of our fingers or merely with sort of goodwill and good intentions. But I think the first step just being to acknowledge that people are struggling and contending with these things, most often through no fault of their own, and that as Christians, we care about that. That matters to us. And you mentioned Rick Warren, a friend of mine at Saddleback Church, pastor, very well known, of course, in the evangelical world and outside of that world as well, who a few years ago started this gathering on mental health and the church. It was an ecumenical event. He partnered with the Catholic Bishop of the Diocese of Orange and hosted it at Saddleback. I think we had about 3,000 people show up to the first of these yearly gatherings. And it was enormously meaningful to people, regardless even of what was said from the stage or from the podium. Just the fact that someone of Rick and Kay's Warren stature and someone of the Bishop of Orange's stature in the Catholic world were standing up and saying, what you're dealing with, what you're contending with matters to us, it matters to the church, and we're here to help you. I think that was a big step, very big step forward. And it's led to all kinds of, I think, good initiatives, grassroots initiatives at the ground level in various churches and Christian communities since then.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I have told Rick this. I mean, just so much respect for the way that he and Kay have shared their story. I mean, obviously, their whole initiative is drawn out of their own story or the story of their son, Matthew, who took his own life after a long struggle with mental illness. And we hosted Rick at an event down in Dallas, and he just sat on the stage on a stool like Rick does and just was so open with it. And it was so absolutely powerful because you mentioned something earlier about, you know, many times at, you know, no fault of their own. Now, that's obviously not a definitive statement when we're talking about some things, but it kind of brings up the question of kind of theological integration, because we have this understanding as Christians of sin and how sin has impacted the world and how our own bad choices kind of impact ourselves. And I think a simplistic understanding of mental illness, you know, a lot of times is, well, you know, stop, you know, there's that Saturday Night Live skit, you know, with Bob Newhart, you know, just stop it. Just stop right. it. I don't know if you've ever seen that. Right. And it's a kind of a Christian thing to do. Now, sometimes you do want to look at people and say, stop it. But we're talking here about something different. We're talking about deep seated troubles, and depression and the dark night of the soul. I mean, theological writers have written about this sort of thing for a really long time. And yet I think a lot of times at church, it's just kind of like, well, just repent and get over it and trust God. Could you talk a little bit about your own understanding? How did you come to balance out, maybe even describe it a bit, kind of your theology and your professional knowledge? How do those two things fit together for you?
Sure. And that's a very good question. It's a complex question to answer, and I'll do my best. And I think the first thing to say is that it's important to draw distinctions and not lump everything into the same category, because there are certainly disorders that psychiatrists treat where free will and a person's consciously motivated behaviors play a significant role in their troubles. One can think of addictions. Even if in the last stage of addictions, because one has become so enslaved to, let's say, a substance of abuse, you know, their free will is probably at that point pretty impaired. At some point in the course of developing that addiction, they made some bad choices. There's no doubt about that. And overcoming that problem is going to require an engagement of the will. And many successful recovery programs, as we know, require that the person lean on a higher power, which is a sort of secularized way of describing the need for God's grace in order to contend with a serious behavioral disorder like an addiction. So there is that on the one hand, but psychiatrists also deal with things that I think are more accurately understood or characterized on a sort of disease model of, you know, a disordered part in the brain. One can think of an illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, what used to be called manic depressive illness, very severe, persistent, potentially serious illnesses that seem to impact roughly the same number of people worldwide, you know, 1-2% of the population in various countries at various points in history. And based on what we know from our growing understanding of the brain and our growing understanding of genetics, these disorders are strongly heritable, 70-80% heritability. People probably come into the world with a very strong predisposition to developing these kinds of disorders, even if they make healthy life choices, even if they do sort of everything right, they can still be afflicted by an illness like this. And we wouldn't want to stigmatize someone who's suffering from an illness like that any more than we would want to stigmatize someone who is contending with cancer or, you know, another serious medical illness. And so psychiatry is complicated. It's a bit of a messy business. And because we're dealing with the human mind, which is influenced both by our biology and by our genes and by these sort of innate factors that are outside of our control, but we're also dealing with the human intellect and a person who at some level ultimately is going to be exercising their freedom and having to engage deliberately in the process of recovery in order to get better. So I like to take a both-and rather than an either-or approach to treating these problems. And what I mean by that is, you take something like depression. We can understand that depression has biological factors that contribute to it, psychological and social factors, a person's relationships, person's behaviors can contribute, spiritual factors that can impact depression, or vice versa. Depression can impact our spiritual life, make it very difficult for us to pray or to feel or sense the awareness of God's presence in our life. And so if a person comes to me and says, well, Dr. Cariotti, should I take a medication or try psychotherapy or pray and read the scriptures more in order to deal with my depression, my answer may be sort of yes to all of the above. And I think we have good empirical evidence for the fact that each of these treatment approaches can hit one aspect of the contributing factors for an illness, a complex illness like depression. We know that prayer and participation in a religious community doesn't immunize us against mental illness on the one hand, but at the same time, we have a growing body of medical evidence that strongly suggests that these practices can help a person in recovery and can reduce the risk of some of the worst outcomes of mental illness. We know that religious faith and especially religious practice, attending church regularly, significantly reduces a person's risk of suicide. Again, that's not to say that Christians are not in danger if they're dealing with a severe mental illness of taking their own lives. They are, and they do, as we know, tragically sometimes end up there. But all other things being equal, the person who has a strong inner conviction of God's love for them and his healing mercy, and who is strongly tied to the Christian community and feels supported by the Christian community and by the church, that person is going to have a significantly lower risk of ending up taking their own lives, even if they're struggling with a serious illness that might otherwise put them at high risk of an outcome like that.
You know, I think that's such an important thing that we need to bring up, because our goal at the Colton Center is to get Christians engaged in the issues of culture. I mean, the great Christians of our forebears didn't run away from the brokenness or the plagues; they ran into it. And it at least seems, and I'm wondering what's the data say. I mean, there seems to be an uptick on mental illness, and I want to talk about cultural factors to that here in just a second. But is it just really an awareness? I mean, are we just kind of more aware of what mental illness is, or are we actually seeing more of it?
Well, I think it's more the latter. So some people have suggested that the rising rates of depression and anxiety, the rising rates of suicide in the United States may be just a function of looser diagnostic categories. We're lumping more people into the category of depression, or maybe we're recognizing it or recognizing more subtle forms more than we used to. I think that's only part of the story. I think there's pretty clear evidence now that the same diagnostic instruments being used, the same kinds of measurement tools being used, show that there is, in fact, a rise in depression, in anxiety disorders, and there's certainly been a rise since 1999 in the United States in suicide among both men and women in every age category up to the age of 75. Suicide has risen significantly since 1999, and the rate of suicide in 10 to 15 year old girls, for example, has tripled during that time, which is just an astonishing and really almost terrifying figure when you think about the mental health of early adolescence. And so this is a serious problem. And John, as you pointed out, our biology hasn't changed significantly since 1999. And so there must be social and cultural factors at work that are making it more difficult for people to live healthy lives, to flourish, and to avoid some of these illnesses like depression, anxiety, and some of these serious behavioral problems like suicide. There's been a very significant research done by Angus Deaton and Ann Case at Princeton on the so-called deaths of despair, death by suicide, by drug overdose, and by alcohol-related illnesses. And they've shown that over the last 15 years in the United States, deaths of despair have risen sharply, and the impact of that has been so significant that the overall life expectancy in the United States has declined over the last 3 years, more than it's declined since the Great Depression. And so this is not something that's just affecting a small slice of the population. This is something that's now impacting the overall life expectancy and mortality rates in our country. And I've been surprised, actually, that more attention hasn't been paid to this problem. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the solutions are going to require sort of very serious work and very serious revaluing and reassessing of where we're at in terms of our culture, in terms of the state of the family in our culture, the state of various mediating institutions in our culture, like churches and other civic organizations. These things seem to be weakening. The social ties between people seem to be fraying. There are rising rates of loneliness in the United States that are really quite astonishing. If you ask people back in the 1980s, do you have someone in your life with whom you can discuss important matters? Very simple survey question. One in five, 20% of people in the United States in the 1982, responded yes to that question, which gets at, you know, a problem of really profound loneliness, not having a friend, a coworker, a family member that I'm close enough to that I can talk with that person about important matters. If you ask that same question today, the number is 40%. So loneliness in the United States, people feeling profoundly socially isolated, that problem has increased really in the last couple of decades as well. And I think that is a major factor that's contributing to what we're seeing in terms of these worsening mental health outcomes among Americans.
Well, it really seems like the perfect storm on a number of levels. On the podcast several weeks ago, we had Patrick Deneen, who talks about the end of liberalism and one of the reasons that, you know, democracy fails. And we're talking here, of course, on a political or geopolitical sense, is that those institutions of civil society, which make people governable, and which keep the need for a big state at bay, that those things have become weaker. And we're talking about, you know, the same thing, but the implications here are personal, not just structural. We're talking about loneliness, and we've, you know, spent a lot of time in my last book talking about how, you know, technology and having constant glowing rectangles about us gives us an illusion of connectedness, but it's not a real connectedness. It's not authentic relationships, you know, that it's mediated. Sherry Turkle's written a lot about that at MIT, where, you know, students, you know, will say things like that, I'd rather text than talk. talk. They want to have everything under their own control, which isn't how real relationships go. And so when they go south, there's not a sense of knowing how to do it, or there's a sense of real, you know, loneliness. Obviously, the breakdown of the family. I mean, you could just kind of go down the line. And we talk about addiction, and addiction, obviously, most of the time is self-medication. I mean, this is a real epidemic. I mean, this is the sort of cultural breakdown. I mean, and you see the implications financially, economically. You see them in terms of stability. This is like a plague. Like if this was, you know, the Ebola virus. I mean, the CDC would have already called it what it is, a pandemic, and that, you know, this is going to cause a lot of problems, and we've got to do something. But we don't seem to have that same sort of outrage.
Yeah, that's right. And that's very concerning to me. I'm glad you mentioned Dineen, who's at my old alma mater, University of Notre Dame. Very fine thinker. His book, I think, is going to be read for many years, Why Liberalism Failed. And one way to think about what I'm doing, what I'm talking about in the Deaths of Despair article in First Things, for example, is this is sort of what's going on downstream of the problems that Dineen puts his finger on with the weakening of civil society and the kinds of robust institutions that are necessary for a healthy and thriving society. When you don't have that, then you get a kind of carnage on the individual level, on the level of individuals and their families. I mean, the leading cause of death overall in the United States for people under the age of 50 is drug overdose. The opioid epidemic is an incredible indictment, I think, on the state of our culture, and especially the state of men in our culture. You have men out of work, not necessarily even looking for jobs, in an economy in which they seem to have been set aside for the sake of global markets. And these men are at home, and they're deeply immersed in video games and pornography and opiates all day long. And they're dying in their third, fourth, fifth decade of life. And while there has been, I think, some more attention now being paid to the opioid epidemic in the United States, I think what we've seen is a bit too little and a bit too late. It took an enormous death toll for people to start waking up and taking notice of this problem. This is by far the worst drug crisis that the United States has ever faced. Far, far worse in terms of morbidity and mortality than the crack cocaine epidemic that we saw in the 1980s. And that's only one among a handful of mental health problems, serious mental health problems that we're facing in this country. So I think you're exactly right. This is a pandemic type of situation, and we have to, I think it's important to step back and recognize that behind every one of those numbers, the 44,000 deaths by suicide in the United States every year, there's a family that's been torn apart. There's deep, deep tragedy. Suicide, as one psychiatrist said, tends to leave skeletons in other people's closets. So not only do you have the loss of a loved one prematurely, oftentimes in sort of the prime of their life, 20s or their 30s, but you have a family that's left behind not only with that complicated grief, but with feelings of guilt and remorse over, could I have done more to help this person? And why didn't I recognize the signs that they were in so much trouble or in danger of such deep despair? And so I think Christians need to call attention to these problems, and we also need to remember that behind every one of those statistics is a human being, someone created in God's image and likeness and redeemed by the blood of Christ. This is a brother or sister of ours who calls on us to reach out and help and figure out how to bind up the wounded. I think on the individual case-by-case level, right, that personal Christian charity that our Lord calls us to, but also to move upstream from that and to think deeply about the cultural and social and political factors that are playing a role in creating a society in which it's harder to be healthy. I would say it's harder to it's harder to be in a state in which you're not going to be so vulnerable to these kinds of problems.
You know, I think it's worth mentioning as well. I mean, you mentioned the, just specifically on the opioid epidemic, but I think what we're seeing too in the mental health crisis, I think there's this thought that, you know, move your kids to, you know, suburbia out of the inner city. The, you know, the crack cocaine crisis was in the inner city. The opioid crisis is across social spectra, and mental illness is across social spectra. You have some of the most miserable people, highest suicide rates among teenagers and so on in some of the wealthiest areas, right? I mean, that's something we've even seen here in Colorado Springs. And I think it's worth mentioning, not that that should make a bit of difference. And that's where I wanted to go next, is that as to what the church can do, because unfortunately, I think if we are waking up, maybe we are waking up to want to run into the brokenness, like our faith calls us to, you know, because it's not, it's impacting us closer to home. And shame on us if that's the case. We should have been paying attention a long time ago, but let me ask you this. I want you to speak to two different groups of people here. We're just near the end of the time. I feel like we have a whole lot more that we could cover. But just near the end of the time here, two groups of people. One is a group of parents or family members. If you were speaking to someone who loves someone struggling with mental illness, and they feel like they have searched the scriptures, they've gone to their pastor, and they're kind of out of resources, what would you tell them? How do you counsel them? Where do you tell them to go? And secondly, what should the church be doing that it's not doing to care for this population?
I guess first addressing the parents or loved ones of someone who's suffering from a mental illness, the first thing that I would say is don't lose hope. The process of recovery, the process of dealing with a mental illness can be a long and difficult one. But most of these illnesses are, if not fully treatable, there are things that can be done to significantly mitigate the suffering and the worst sort of adverse consequences of these illnesses. So reach out to your church for help. Reach out to your pastor to see if there are mental health professionals that they recommend that take a sort of integrated approach to treatment, looking at all different aspects of these illnesses, as I've described earlier on the show. And if that's not available, don't be afraid to go see a competent psychiatrist who may not be a Christian. Find someone who is respectful of your convictions in terms of faith and morals. They don't necessarily have to share them, but they do have to be competent in their craft of evaluating mental illness and providing good treatment recommendations. Don't close yourself off automatically to the idea of taking medication for an illness like that. It's not the only treatment approach for most of these things, but in many cases it can be helpful. And in some cases it can be even potentially life-saving. What I would say in terms of what the churches can do is, first of all, think about the fact that there are people sitting there in the pew next to you. They're not far away. They're not over, as you said, John, in the inner cities and not really sort of shoulder to shoulder with us here in the suburbs. They're right there with me in my community. But I may not be aware of it because of the stigma of mental illness. I may not even recognize that someone may be struggling with this, that someone may have a loved one who is recently hospitalized on a psychiatric ward for a mental illness. They don't want to talk about it. So I think leaders in the church can begin praying for folks publicly that are dealing with mental illness and addictions. Churches can begin to form small support groups so that people can come together and recognize I'm not the only one in this community who is dealing with personally a problem like this, or is maybe trying to help a loved one who's dealing with a problem like this. Even if more or less the same kind of thing happens at a support group like that would happen, you know, in another context, the fact that it is hosted at and endorsed by or supported by a local church, I think is enormously meaningful to people in terms of just feeling like their pain, their problems, their difficulties are being recognized and acknowledged in the same way that the church would support other folks that are dealing with medical illnesses, let's say, praying for them, providing supportive care for them, meal trains, if someone is in the hospital, things of that nature. I think those with mental illnesses often feel sort of unrecognized or, if not outright excluded from that kind of care and concern from the Christian community. So I think a few initial steps actually can go a long way. And then once churches begin moving in that direction, people can sort of take up the charge and begin doing work on their own in this area. I think grassroots initiatives will grow up if the pastor or if the leaders at the church say this is important to us. People will come forward that have dealt with this, that have expertise in this, whether mental health professionals or patients and families dealing with these issues, and say, okay, well, we have something that we think can be helpful here, and we'd like to implement it. So it's not as though the pastors or the church leaders need to do all the work themselves, but I think they need to give things an initial nudge and to publicly acknowledge the problem and make it clear to their congregation or their community that this is something that's important to us because of who we are, not just because people are suffering, but because as Christians, we're called to respond to them with the compassion that Christ showed to the sick that he healed.
Well, I'm so happy that God has placed you in this position, and he's using you, I think you and your work, to bring a lot of attention to this and also some constructive solutions. Please visit us at breakpoint.org and click on the link on the homepage that says resources mentioned on the radio and podcast. And we'll link you to the articles by Dr. Aaron Cariotti and to his work so that you can be better equipped, better informed, and you can have a place to go as you encounter those with mental illness. And I pray that the church would become a bastion in a society where there's not a whole lot of institutions of civil society left that are providing the sort of identity formation and meeting the mental needs of so many people, that the church could maybe play that role like I believe it's been ordained to do. So, Dr. Cariotti, it's been a pleasure to have you on the Breakpoint podcast. Thanks for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to the Breakpoint Podcast. If you listen via iTunes, we'd appreciate you rating the Breakpoint Podcast. Thanks.